Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, coming to you live from the Toby Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club, it's Week to Week, your political roundtable. It's Wednesday, November 7th, 2018. You did it. You got through the election. Congratulations. So welcome to our special election aftermath political roundtable, in which we'll take stock of what happened yesterday. Who won? Was it the Russian hackers or the Chinese hackers? We'll find out. It was quite a wild election night. Obviously, we've been talking about it nonstop back there. I'm sure you've been talking about it. It was a kind of night with all these surprising twists and turns that result in headlines like this, and I'm not making this up. Dead pimp wins in Nevada landslide. Actual headline. Well, I'm John Zipper. I'm your host for Week to Week. And on today's program, obviously, we're going to go over all the big races from yesterday, some of the major propositions locally and statewide, and in other states that made the news yesterday. And we'll just kind of try to get into the results and the meaning of this big midterm election. Now, regardless of whoever you voted for, you're welcome here at the Commonwealth Club. Any opinions that are expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Let's meet our panelists for today. I'll start on the far end of the stage with Melissa Kane. She's a political and legal reporter for CBS Bay Area. That's KPIX. Welcome back, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
Making her first appearance on our week-to-week panel, but not her first appearance on the club stage, is Katie Hafner. Oh, excuse me. I went out of order. Right next to me, let me do this, is Katie Hafner. She's a journalist and contributor to the New York Times. She's the author of Mother, Daughter, Me, and she's on Twitter at Katie Hafner. So welcome, Katie. And now let me go back to the middle. Molly Riley returns to us. She's an assignment editor at HuffPost, and you can follow her on Twitter at Molly Riley. So welcome back, Molly.
Thank you.
Can we start with the Jeff Sessions thing?
Or we just will. Tell them. We will. What?
Just tell them.
Okay. Folks, breaking news if you haven't been following your news. I think you're all getting the alerts right now. So Jeff Sessions was just fired. It's true. Or asked to resign. Mm-hmm. But yes, and so we will talk about that a little bit more, but that's kind of breaking news day, I think it's going to be. Let's just start first with, now, and I'm talking to three news people here. Two of them I know were up doing coverage either on the air or at HuffPost, but I'll start with Melissa and just work on down. What was your initial headline reaction to what was going on last night? What's the biggest thing that hit you?
Well, so there's nationally, I think the biggest thing for me, or the biggest surprise, was Florida. I really thought it would be a lot closer, both the Senate race and the governor's race. I think we were there was a lot of hype around the Democrats running in those races, and the fact that they were called relatively early in a state where counting, as we know, can go on for days and months, and that there were concession speeches last night was a real surprise. Locally, I would say it's really status quo here. I mean, we have a new Democrat governor. We have Nancy Pelosi reelected. We've got Dianne Feinstein reelected. We're not changing rent control rules. We are not, repealing the gas tax. So from a local perspective, not a lot changed in light of the election yesterday. And that was, for me, the big headline was sort of everything is the same, pretty much on the local level, at least, here in California.
Okay, Molly, what stood out to you?
Well, on a national level, I think what was really interesting is the last two elections, we've seen these big wins for Republicans in the Senate and the House. And last night, we saw a split for the first time in a while. So that is going to change a lot of the dynamics of the Trump presidency. The Republicans gained a few seats in the Senate, so that's going to make it a lot easier for Trump to get through his judicial confirmations and these cabinet confirmations, which is going to come in handy as he starts cleaning house. We already have Sessions out. I think we're going to see a couple more resignations in the next couple of days, and he's going to need the Senate to confirm those people. But with the House now back in control of the Democrats, that's going to change the legislative dynamics. The filibuster for legislative bills is 60 votes in the Senate, so they're not going to be able to ram through things like Obamacare repeal, immigration issues that they want to pass through. So that's really going to change the calculations of what Trump is able to do the next 2 years.
Very good. Katie?
I have to say it was the women. I was not surprised that so many women won, but I was surprised. I was a little bit blindsided because I've been hearing about this for so many years, and it feels like it sort of it bubbled up and suddenly exploded. I have a friend who started Emerge America, which mentors have people heard of Emerge? It mentors women. It's the one that was famously in a tweet on Breitbart that called it dangerous. There are women running. It's dangerous. And I asked this friend of mine who started Emerge if she was surprised that so many women were running. This was before yesterday, and then I hope we can follow up on this a little bit later.
Yeah.
I just want to read you her response. She said, "I'm not surprised because so many women had such a visceral response to the 2016 election, and Trump removed one of the barriers that women have when considering running for office, which is that they might not be qualified as women..." It gets better. "As women hold themselves to a higher standard than men, Trump makes clear that anybody is qualified." So I hope we'll talk more about the women.
Okay, well, let's stick with the House. A changeover in power coming. Molly, I mean, what do you think we can expect from a new House majority of Democrats? Are they going to be aggressive? Are they going to be cautious? And, of course, the big question, is Nancy Pelosi going to reclaim the Speaker's gavel?
I think on the last point, 100% Nancy Pelosi will be Speaker of the House. She has said herself she's not going anywhere. In a lot of ways, she's earned this. You know, she helped get them back to this place with, 26 seats up. She's a fundraising machine. She has respect on both sides. You know, they criticize her a lot openly in the Republican Party, but I think there is that level of respect. And even Trump had to hand it to her today in his press conference. On your other points, are they going to be aggressive? I think we will see, there's going to be changeover on these committees. People like Adam Schiff is going to be the head of the Intelligence Committee. I think we're going to see a lot of investigations. I think those Trump tax returns are going to get subpoenaed, even though Trump says he's not going to hand them over because he says people won't understand them. I think we are going to see a lot more aggression from the House.
Can I just say, so this morning, Nancy Pelosi had a press conference, and there were the usual questions, and she said, we're going to try to work with them on infrastructure, we're going to try to work with them on negotiating drug prices and bringing drug prices down. And then, of course, one of the reporters began to ask the question, "Do you think," she goes, "Yes, absolutely." And what they were, "Do you think you will remain Speaker?" And she goes, she didn't even let him finish the question. She was like, "Oh yeah, I am." And then the next person asked a similar question. She said, "Listen, yes, I'm not going to answer any more questions about this. I'm going to continue to be the Speaker. I'm the negotiator. I'm the, I'm the one who's, shown myself to be entirely successful at doing what a Speaker needs to do. End of questions." So that's her perspective. Now, for some folks in the House, particularly people on the left who are younger representatives who are going to maybe even think about challenging her, or say we're on the fence, they may push her to move things a little more aggressively in order to sort of keep the team together if there's a group that's sort of trying to pull her to the left. So that might actually even sort of encourage or speed up some of the investigations and other things that they can do to the Trump administration. But it seems pretty clear, not only that Nancy Pelosi is very confident about her position as Speaker, but also that there really is no one, and this is a constant issue, right, is that there really is no one poised to challenge her in a meaningful way, particularly after this series of wins that she was instrumental in helping to engineer.
And I'm not just playing to the audience or my panel when I say this, but if she were a man, do you think people would be saying, "He's too old to be Speaker again"?
Well, no, people, take issue with Bernie Sanders for being too old. I think even Joe Biden has faced very serious questions about his age. So I don't know that it's entirely that. I think it's some part of that, but not... Not 100%. I think there are older folks, and I think what they mean by age or old is that they've just been there a really long time, and it's not necessarily that they are a particular age. It's that, you know, you've got a whole group of folks who are trying to move into leadership positions who feel like they have been blocked out since the 90s. Which isn't necessarily, you know, it's a cousin to the age issue, but I think the staying power is something that some folks resent.
Okay, yeah. Katie, why don't you explain to us what we're seeing on the two side panels here? This is a New York Times
right. Grit, you know, image. Okay, so I'm not a political reporter. Just have to tell you that right up front. I write mostly about healthcare. I'd be happy to talk about Medicare with anybody. However, I was on the phone yesterday with my editor at the Times. I said, okay, what's it like in the newsroom right now? And she said, lots of chocolate. And then she said, good chocolate. I said, really? Not awful chocolate? That's what I would have thought, because reporters are known to eat pretty much anything that's put in front of them. She said, no, really good chocolate. So, as she said, it was, you know, as usual, you can imagine the buzz in the newsroom in New York yesterday was incredible. And one of the things that we you know, everyone's been dancing around is this question of the needle. And because so many people have PTSD from the needle from 2016. And I don't know if you guys remember that, obviously you do, but, you know, the feeling. In fact, my daughter refused to let me even go near the needle yesterday because she has PTSD. The Times has been working really hard to do other things. They did use the needle, which was surprising to me that they decided to use it. However, this is really interesting. It's actually interactive. I just wanted to give you a still shot of it. It's interactive if you go on the Times site, and you can see, a lot of websites have this, these interactive maps to say what's happening with the races, but you can actually see, I mean, there was this question last night, early in the evening, about whether it was really a blue wave. Is there really a blue wave? I think this pretty well sums up a lot of it.
So it's showing which districts shifted either to blue for Democrats or red to Republicans.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting way to look at it. And then if you go on the website, and I would encourage you to do this, it'll then morph into just the dots, and then you can look at it more interactively. But yeah, this sums it up really nicely. And I'd be interested in hearing your reactions to this. You know, what they're saying about last night, what about yesterday, is that, you know, blue stayed blue, red stayed red, blue got bluer, red got redder. So you're not really seeing that much of a difference.
Well, you're seeing a lot of blue shifts in deep South states there.
That's
and
true.
Of course, some red shifts over there in California. We all know about Californians. So yeah, no, I love these kind of maps because they really kind of help you when you're sometimes following specific races and, you know, the candidate you were hoping didn't win or something like that. You know, those things will have an outsized impact on your view of things. Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask a question from the audience. Do you think Democrats now in control of the House will introduce legislation and not just talk about investigations?
You know, so Nancy Pelosi outlined last night she outlined a very, you know, aggressive agenda. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there with Phil Mateer. We were doing a little election analysis saying, I don't know what you're talking about, especially now that Republicans have even more seats in the Senate. The likelihood of introducing and getting through a strictly Democratic-backed measure, you know, fine in the House, but even assuming you can corral, you know, Democrats and Republicans also vary, right?
Yeah.
You know, so assuming you can corral enough in the House, which Pelosi has proven to be pretty good at, you know, we have even bigger trouble trying to get something through the Senate. So I think they can introduce all day long, just like Republicans did when they were in the minority and they, you know, kept trying to repeal Obamacare every week. So, you know, just, you know, you can do it for show, but in terms of actually getting things done, that's pretty doubtful. It looks like a lot of what they'll be doing in the House is stopping anything that starts in the Senate and investigating the president, and not just him, but his cabinet. I mean, one of the things Pelosi talked about this morning is investigating the EPA for various issues. So, I mean, that's, you know, it won't just be limited to the president. There's other folks that they can be looking at as well.
Katie, you looked like you were about to say something.
Yeah, well, Melissa, when you were talking about healthcare, I mean, one thing, I think it's important that we get it on the table right now, which is, and this was a big Pelosi point, is sticking to healthcare, emphasizing healthcare, and this idea of staying on that message versus what Trump did, which was go off the message that people like Paul Ryan wanted him to be on, which was the economy. And she, and that, you know, that agenda of hers seems to have worked, or do you agree?
Oh, I think so. And I think, you know, one of the questions she got today was, you know, should the Democrats have said more about the immigration situation? Was it a good idea to stay quiet when the president was ramping up his rhetoric on the caravan, et cetera? And she said, I told our members to stay the course. Don't take the bait, is what she said. Don't take the bait. Talk about health care. That is what people care about. And that's what people are concerned about with this administration. And it's, you know, it seemed to have worked pretty well overall.
I would throw out two things. Rick Wilson is a GOP strategist. Some of you were probably at his program when he was here. And he was asked about Democrats and what they should do. And he was like, look, forget about impeachment. But he was saying, you can do death of a thousand cuts. You investigate, investigate, investigate. He's a GOP strategist, of course, who is very anti-Trump.
Well, one of the things that Pelosi also has said is that she would not support impeachment unless it was bipartisan. She said any move to impeach would have to be something that's bipartisan. So yeah. For what that's worth, she's already, at least in her mind, that's what that would look like.
Well, and the other thing I wanted to mention that he brought up was talking about Democrats and Hispanic voters. And he said Democrats like to talk to Hispanic voters and say, you know, it's immigration. We're working on immigration. He's like, you know what they Hispanics tell pollsters is their number one topic? Healthcare and jobs. Mm-hmm. Immigration's it affects them, and it's somewhere on the list, but it's like down here. It's healthcare and jobs. So sounds like that worked for the Democrats. I don't know yet. No, of course, in specific areas where Hispanic votes made a difference or underperformed or anything. But that would be one thing I would look in as the days go on and we get more and more data on individual districts. Mm-hmm. Great question for when we get to the city stuff. Thank you. So now, last I saw, there were still a couple dozen House seats waiting to, yeah. Does anyone know, and this might be something we don't know yet, but does anyone know where they're trending or what we possibly could expect? I understood they were mostly current Republican incumbents. Mm-hmm. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I know Dana Rohrabacher looked like he was heading for a loss, but they still are counting ballots there.
Right.
Issa's seat, which is two newcomers running for that seat, looked like it was going to go to the Democrat. Jeff Denham in the Central Valley was looking like he might lose. So it looks like there were a couple upsets. Katie Hill looked like she was going to win in Southern California. But then there were a couple, the Mimi Walters, Katie Porter race looked like it was heading towards Walters. So there still are a couple in contention, but it did look like Democrats were going to be able to flip a few of those Southern California races that everyone had their eye on.
I would note that this is just an inside thing. Donna Shalala down in Florida flipped a seat. Donna Shalala was chancellor of my university when I was back in school. But she flipped a seat that it had started to look like it was getting closer and closer, but it apparently was a fairly easy win for her. What about some of the Senate races? Claire McCaskill lost, and she lost pretty big. Did that surprise anyone, or was that just kind of a matter of time in Missouri?
I think it was, you know, a matter of time for her to lose, but the margin by which she lost, we were talking about this earlier, is pretty surprising. She lost by 10 points, I think, and that's pretty big.
That's a landslide.
And it's interesting, too, because in Missouri, they did have some progressive ballot measures passed. They passed a higher minimum wage there. And so there is kind of this discrepancy in a couple states. In Florida, the same sort of thing happened. Andrew Gillum lost, but the state passed a proposition that would reinstate voting rights for felons. Mm-hmm. And that's a very progressive position. A couple states that were, you know, more red states passed Medicaid expansion. Utah passed a medical marijuana bill. So at the proposition level, a lot of progressive issues did pretty well. But for whatever reason, a lot of these Democrats running in these red trending states just couldn't pull off a victory. So I think that's going to be something really interesting for the party to look at going forward about what kind of candidates they're putting forward and what kind of issues these candidates are going to need to get behind in order to get the vote.
And we'll probably need some more exit polling information, but I don't think it's any coincidence that these are the three Democrats who voted in favor of they voted against Brett Kavanaugh. And the one that did not ended up keeping his seat. And so, causation, correlation, not totally clear. But these three folks, I think, knew that they were in some trouble when they cast their vote. And, from a polling perspective, several of them saw, some impact. Whether or not it was the overall issue, we're not clear on. But I did ask Senator Feinstein about this. I said, some Democrats really got hit with this, the whole Kavanaugh confirmation process. I said, if you had to do it over again, would you do it the same way? And she said, yes, I would. I would have handled it totally the same way. History will judge us, et cetera. But she at least seemed to think that what the Democrats did there was worth it. We'll know more as we get some more research on exactly what impact that had. But when you're passing progressive reforms and yet ousting a Democrat for Senate, it definitely begs the question: what did that person do, as opposed to making it an ideological fight?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think another interesting race was, and you might have something to say on this because of healthcare, but Nevada, Dean Heller lost, and he, this feels like ancient history now, but last summer in 2017, he supported the efforts to repeal Obamacare in the Senate, where John McCain famously came out on the Senate floor at midnight and stopped the bill from passing. And I think those are the kind of things that voters remember. Healthcare hits home for these voters.
Katie?
Yeah, so when you said causation, one thing that struck me today in Trump's press conference was when he was talking about the embrace, and it's now a hashtag, the embrace. So he said, those who decided to take the embrace won, and then he started talking about the losers. Your loss, sorry about that, and started listing all the losers who didn't accept the embrace. He made it seem like there was a direct relationship between his showing up to stump for these people and the victory, when in fact, I think it has much more to do with those who just ran with him and those who were distancing themselves.
Yeah, actually, of the candidates he endorsed, most of them lost.
Right.
That he actually, I think he endorsed, officially endorsed. He endorsed 33 of them and only 12 won, or at least as of last I saw.
But the way he made it sound, it's like, it's all your fault. You didn't take the embrace. Should have done it.
some other things of note. We talked about the larger number of women who ran and won. Also, we have the first ever Native American women elected to Congress, both Democrats from New Mexico.
Two Muslims who took time off their time on the caravan, took some time out to run for office.
First openly gay governor in Colorado, Democrat Jared Polis, if I'm pronouncing that right. Tammy Baldwin, again from my home state, won a landslide in her reelection. And of course, let's kind of shift from the House and the Congress enough to start talking about some of the governor races, where Democrats have, they said, basically reassembled something of a blue wall in the upper Midwest. Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, I don't consider Kansas Midwest, I consider it South, but most people consider it Midwest. Melissa, what did you think about the gubernatorial races?
Well, governor's races are interesting. Well, maybe all races have this issue, but if you look at like a Kris Kobach out of Kansas, mm-hmm. Just a uniquely terrible candidate. Regardless, it's like a sort of a Roy Moore thing. Like, it's not even like a political thing at some point. I think there were a lot of people who were even Republicans who did not like this guy. I mean, he made just a real public spectacle of issues. And it's not just whatever you think about voter fraud, what he did during the trial or didn't do during the trial. Over his efforts to get voter information was just really bananas. So you hesitate to read too much into a governor's race, because it really is, on a statewide level, when you're talking about the executive, it can come down to that person and their personal qualifications, regardless of your ideology. But as a Georgian, I was watching the race, the governor there, governor's race there very closely. And I was I believed that she probably wouldn't win ultimately, just for because of, you know, many decades of knowing that place and knowing my people. But I was surprised at how she never really even sort of got into the running. She never really got over 50%. Even when the Atlanta returns came in, they didn't bring her up that much. It's still a question mark. She's waiting for absentee ballots and a number of other things to be counted. If they don't get to 50%, if neither gets to 50%, then there would be a runoff. I don't think that would help her very much. I think people in the runoff are going to be even less likely to vote for her. But I think but the surprise there was that it wasn't closer, that she never really got, you know, even in California, for a minute, John Cox was ahead. Remember? So when you start, when the returns start coming in from the sort of more rural areas, he was up for one of the rounds. And so, you know, you expect that kind of flip-flopping to happen as things come in. And that really never even happened with her. So, I mean, when Oprah and, you know, is campaigning for you, you think you get at least a little bit there. So I was surprised at how sort of depressed that was, even though it's very close.
Yeah, and on that race, you know, even though it's looking, you know, it may end up going to, you know, a recount or even a, I'm listening to what
runoff.
A runoff. But she gave the speech when she spoke to her supporters in Atlanta last night, and my Twitter feed was just blowing up. People were quoting her, tweeting out videos of it, and so I think this really is a Star is Born moment for her, regardless of what happens in the end. She's now a national persona, and I think the Democrats need more of these national personas if they're going to, you know, inspire young voters to keep turning out like they did last night. Andrew Gillum is another one that I think a lot of young people found to be truly inspiring, and, you know, he had Obama campaigning for him as he did for Abrams. Those kinds of people that are coming up in these governor races, I think, are going to be really important to keep an
eye on. And we just need a new rule. We need a new rule. If you are the Secretary of State and you want to run for higher office,
recusal.
Take a sabbatical. Like, there's no way. We've had this twice with Kansas and and in Georgia. Should not be a thing. I don't know. We got to call your representative in California and get that rule in place before it happens here, because it is just, regardless of your politics, a terrible, terrible way to run things. And it puts a shadow on the whole process. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Katie?
So speaking of rising young stars, we have to talk about Beto.
Beto O'Rourke in Texas.
And I have to say, my daughter's a native Texan, which means I've actually lived there by definition. And I, you know, what do you guys think about the Hispanic turnout, which seemed, I mean, just watching him on TV in El Paso, where I've also spent a lot of time, that was to me quite incredible.
Yeah, I had a lot of friends going down to Texas to volunteer for him, and these are friends that had never been involved in politics ever. And it was Beto mania, and, you know, and I think he got a lot closer than anyone expected to see.
Yeah, I mean, in a red state.
Yeah.
In a really red state. I mean, Ann Richards notwithstanding, and then there was the Democratic governor. No one remembers Mark White also. But this is a state that is an incredibly hard nut to crack.
But Beto, they also hate Ted Cruz. I mean, it wasn't like Beto. I mean, Beto's great, but he also was running against somebody who was loathed by many Republicans in Texas. So, I mean, I think, you know, the closeness is sort of a combination of both. You know, Beto's obviously, you know, ginning up a lot of people's enthusiasm, but also Ted Cruz just being uniquely really unpopular among even Republicans, many Republicans in that state as well. So I think it was set up in a way that I think, you know, is what is giving us the close result.
Okay. Let's give away another book. So another quiz question, remember, raise your hand. This book is To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. Almost every week to week for the past 2 years, I get at least one question from the audience on, you know, when will he be impeached? How do we impeach him? Can he be impeached? Dear God, what do we do about this impeachment thing? This is a book by Lawrence Tribe and Joshua Matz. It'll probably explain all that. So the question is, how large of a vote does it take in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate to impeach a president? Does anyone know?
Right here.
Right there.
Majority.
Very good. It's different in the two houses. I was afraid someone would get half of it. Thank you. Congratulations, David. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why, well, it's the main reason I think a lot of folks have been saying to Democrats, don't bother dreaming about impeachment, right? You're not going to get two-thirds in the Senate.
It'll just be like the Bill Clinton situation where the House votes to impeach, but he doesn't get removed because the Senate is not voting to convict, I guess is the technical. So you might just end up martyring him.
Let's talk propositions for a while here. And let's start off actually very local here in San Francisco. All of them passed, right? And they passed quite overwhelmingly. They're going to rebuild the seawall, which is actually just a couple hundred feet out there. That means the Commonwealth Club won't have to become a scuba diving club anytime soon. But of course, the big attention was on Prop C. And any thoughts on that? I mean, that got probably the most attention of any of the local propositions, and it got a lot of attention from outside because of the Mark Benioff and yeah. The whole billionaire fight.
Yeah, Jack Dorsey versus Mark was fun to watch on Twitter for a couple of weeks there. But yeah, I think, you know, anyone who lives in San Francisco, you know, walks around and they see that homelessness is, if not the biggest issue, one of the biggest issues facing our cities today. And I think people are really hungry for solutions. They want to see something done. And the argument that, well, if we raise the money, what's money going to go to? How exactly are we going to spend it? Trying to figure that out beforehand, I think just didn't resonate with people as much as just saying, no, we have to do something. And this is a concrete action we can take.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Just to be clear, there's some legal issues here, right? So it was passed with a majority so far. I mean, we're still counting, but not a supermajority. There is a question about you can collect the tax, but can you actually spend the tax because you didn't get the two-thirds majority? So there will be some legal wrangling here probably for a while, so it's not going to take effect quickly. Weird, and it wasn't in the ballot because it's like weird and complicated. But to your point, when you're starting to ask questions about, well, actually, technically, if you look at this, there's an old saying in politics that if you're explaining, you're losing. And so when you look at something and it's like, oh, we're going to tax super rich companies to, you know, do stuff for the homeless problem, like, don't mind if I do. Like, it's a very, for folks who just are looking at this for the first time, it's a really no-brainer kind of question. And so when folks are trying to, you know, make all of the sort of sub-points about the issues around funding and what this is going to mean for the homeless problem, it's a lot of complication. And so it's not surprising that this won. I think the no on C folks had a real high hill to climb to start with to try to convince people that no, let's not. Here are the 10 reasons why we shouldn't do this.
Now assuming, leaving aside any legal challenges to the two-thirds or whatever, assuming so that money is there, who decides how it is spent? Is that supervisors? Is that Mayor London Breed? Is that Mark Benioff? I mean,
there's an advisory council.
And how do I get on this?
You can get appointed by the mayor. You can get appointed by the Board of Supervisors. I believe the controller's office has one person that they appoint. And there's another. I think that there's another person that gets appointed. It's about seven. I think it's like seven people on the advisory council that spends the money. So. There you go. And then there's also the issue of all, you know, we're always concerned about right now we're spending like $300 million a year on homeless services. Are we just going to move that over and pay for something else and bring this on in and end up in a net similar situation as opposed to, you know, sort of putting it on top of what we already spend, which I think is the intent. But as is often the case, anybody who watches politics, you know, as soon as you raise the taxes over here for something, you're just going to suck that money over and pay for something else that's less popular.
Money is fungible.
And so, you know, you could end up, you know, sort of back at zero, even though we've got this new tax money coming in.
Interesting.
We'll see.
Okay. So what about some of the statewide propositions? The gas tax repeal did not pass. That was kind of the Hail Mary by the Republicans. Go ahead, Katie.
Right. And the question, you know, that was the one that Jerry Brown really jumped in on and said, no, no, no. And I just want to say about these things, you know, they are so oddly and often deceptively and cryptically worded. There has to be, can we like have a proposition on the wording on these things? Unbelievable. It really is hard to figure it out unless you really spend a lot of time figuring out what's hidden. And we are not the only state that does this.
I do have to jump in, which is sort of related. Back in around 2000 in Canada, there was a candidate who was very conservative called Stockwell Day. And part of his party's platform was to introduce these national referendums, and with a pretty low threshold for how many signatures you'd need to get it on the thing. And so some people gathered enough signatures that would have legally changed his name to Doris Day had his referendum had been the law of the land, which it wasn't. Go ahead.
What happened?
He lost. So okay. It didn't.
If his name is Doris Day.
Yeah, Stockwell or Doris lost.
So, but for instance, the dialysis Proposition 8, my daughter, who is a medical student at UCSF, she said, oh, yeah, yes, Mom, yes. And I said, well, wait on. Let's really think this through. I mean, it's one of those, we do want to cap what they can charge. It's not really what this was about. And it's really hard to get at the heart of this unless you spend a lot of time reading not the proposition, not the wording of the measure itself, but the incredible work that goes into the analysis by a lot of people of this. So that was one that could easily have been misconstrued, but it went down. What else?
Well, when the gas tax thing is interesting, because if you poll it and say, and I'm sure you've seen this, if you poll it and say, do you want to repeal the gas tax? Yes. Yeah. Like 60% of people say yes. But when you word it that funky way that the state attorney general worded it, which was, do you hate roads, basically? less so. And so actually the gas tax folks are suing now.
Oh, really?
They're suing. And I'm not clear. It's not clear to me where that's going to go in light of the voting results, but they were in the process of suing, saying you absolutely screwed this up. And initially what they submitted, the initial question was supposed to be, do you want to repeal the gas tax or repeal the gas tax? Yes or no. Simple. And then the state attorney general is the one who put in the funky wording. So now they're suing, saying you're purposefully making this complicated so that it will, it'll confuse people, and it's not an accurate reflection as the law requires. So there is a legal action out there. Again, I don't know what's going to happen to it, but they say that they're going to come back and try to go to the ballot again. So maybe they'll continue to pursue that, but it has real, real consequences.
What about the rent control expansion?
Oh, that was another one.
Yeah, I think that one was
very tricky.
Too.
A lot of money went into that very controversial
the
one.
The No on 10 campaign was extremely well funded, and signs everywhere. And I think that's another one that without the voter education and doing the research on what it actually means to repeal Costa-Hawkins, people are just going to vote no. And I think that's a really hard one to get people.
And it's a hard one to get people in rural areas to care about. I mean, it's something in urban areas we care about very much, but it's harder to convince someone in Inyo County that this is a real, that this is a real issue. And so if they're not convinced on one side, it's very easy to say, oh, well, no, never mind.
Mm-hmm. Daylight savings time. Bye-bye. Anyone
see, that one actually confused a lot of people too, I think.
Of course.
Because allowing the legislators to consider it. And then it also has to be approved by the U.S. Congress for us to be able to even change it. And then there's confusion over are we keeping daylight savings? Are we not having it anymore? Do we not change the clocks back? So that one is kind of all over the place too. Yeah.
But this one, actually, I'm going to relate that to the dialysis one. Bear with me. I promise I'll get somewhere. So the reason we had this daylight savings time thing on the ballot, even though it seems silly and just sort of like a policy statement, is because back in 1949, we voted the current situation. And so, as you know, whenever you vote something in, the only way to get it out is for another vote to happen. And so, because the legislature can't just go in and change it. So that's why we have to have this thing on the ballot to undo the 1949 initiative. So what does this mean about dialysis? Well, one of the issues with Prop 8 is that if something weird happened, no one, even the legislative analyst, was like, we don't know what's going to happen if this passes. The idea that you might need to go in and tinker with it to make sure that people are still able to have access to dialysis, it would have had to come back to the voters to make any amendments, just like the daylight savings time thing did. So one of the, I think one of the more compelling arguments, regardless of what you think about dialysis companies and their profits, is who should be able to work really quickly to make changes to make sure people still have access to their health care, depending on who knows what's going to happen. It shouldn't be us, right? We shouldn't have to keep coming back and tweaking, this very complicated, system of profit capping. That should be done in the legislature, where they can ideally do it a lot more quickly. And so we don't have to have, in 20 years, something come back and go, why are we voting on this again? Well, that's why, we're making work for ourselves by passing things that might need to be changed in the future.
And we touched on this a little bit earlier, but before we move on, some of the propositions in other states, Katie, what jumped out at you?
Yeah, well, we had, interestingly, what Molly was saying about these red states passing these really progressive initiatives. I mean, we had several states legalizing marijuana, medical marijuana, and decriminalizing marijuana. North Dakota didn't, unfortunately, but Missouri and Mississippi, and then increasing minimum wage. That got voted for in Arizona and Missouri. This another one that was on our ballot, this right to privacy business, which was unbelievably difficult to understand, that one, which it was supposed to be about transparency, but it really was questionable about
almost opaque transparency.
Opaque transparency. But anyway, several states are getting into this question of privacy, which is interesting that they end up on these state ballots.
Yeah.
Then the felons in restoring voting rights, I think it's 1.5 million felons can
just,
now
just
vote
in Florida.
Florida. If only it had been.
There are a lot of felons in Florida.
2 weeks ago.
Just think about that. Okay, well. I wanted to get a little bit of time for just kind of what the, I mean, we've all just been through a very, very long election, and we have about 73 hours before we start running through the 2020 campaign. So let's talk a bit about kind of what have we just been through. There are a number of questions that folks have asked about, was the turnout what we expected? Did the various groups that were expected to vote in certain ways, high or low or whatever, did they do that? And we'll be getting more of this info as we get more exit poll results and follow-up surveys and such. But from what we know now, I'll ask it this way, but you can take it where you want. Melissa, was this a blue wave?
No. I think it was a blue, I've heard blue ripple, blue puddle. I've heard of, but it wasn't, because when the Senate goes even more red and when governor's races are pretty well split, each side sort of picked up from the other, you've got a number of House races, of course, but a lot of those, these were expected to go back to the Democrats. A lot of them were turned red when Donald Trump was on the ballot and brought out a lot of voters, and Hillary Clinton didn't. Yeah. So for a number of these seats, they were expected to go back to blue, which is something that they had been. So I don't know that necessarily we want to read so much into that, but I will say this. Pollsters seem to have gotten their groove back, because after 2016, they're all like, what are we doing? There's a lot of soul searching, I think, among pollsters after that to make sure that they were weighting things properly. And they were so careful, I think, this time around. And I think they ended up being pretty spot on. I mean, if you read 538, and, as I'm sure many of you do, a number of these predictors in terms of, suburban, college-educated folks voting certain ways, et cetera, turned out to be pretty accurate. And so while we didn't see, huge. I mean, look at all the red arrows in California. I mean, Come on. So, even though we didn't see, a huge blue wave, it wasn't the Senate and, huge amounts in the House and et cetera, it's still meaningful, but it's still something that was predicted in a way that I think folks after 2016 were really nervous about being accurate on.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, what I'm kind of seeing is that they needed to, in both parties, get young people engaged in politics again. And I think this election cycle has done that. Turnout was really high among young people from what we've seen so far. And there's all these candidates now that young people are really, really excited about. You know, you have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York, who's the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. You have all these historic firsts that we just talked about, the first Muslim woman in Congress. Ayanna Pressley in Massachusetts is the first Black woman to represent Massachusetts in the House. I think it's 96 women are going to be in Congress, and that's, or in the House alone, not counting the Senate. And that's the first time there's ever been that close to 100 women in the House. So these are, you know, these are important numbers, and I think they're really inspiring to people. And I think it's going to build on that momentum. There are a lot of people that are getting engaged in politics that weren't before. A lot of people running for office that had never run for office before. And that's just going to keep building. And I think another area that's important to not overlook when we're talking about a blue wave is state legislatures. Democrats took a lot of flack in 2014 for effectively ignoring the importance of keeping these state houses.
Yeah.
And they're starting to crawl back a little bit there. New York, for example, the state Senate there has been controlled by Republicans for a few years. They won that back. They now control all three branches of government. So that's, you know, these are big, big wins for Democrats and progressives. And I think that's important to look at, even if it isn't reflected in the Senate numbers.
Katie?
Yeah, I'd like to say two things. One is the young people voting. Yesterday I was at Suvla, my favorite trendy salad place, on DeVis, and I said to the young guy behind the counter, "Well, are you?" He said, "Not only am I voting," and this guy, I live by anecdote. He said, "Not only am I voting, but he's from Palmdale, where Katie Hill's now." Katie Hill, he said his parents, he converted them to Democrats, he got them to vote for her. And I thought, oh, I love you, bless you. And I was so distracted, I forgot to give him a tip. And
it's the last time he votes.
I know, right? And then, so I have huge faith. And look at our 29-year-old congresswoman-elect. It's quite amazing. But then there's this question of polling. And, you know, we've always known that in 2016, the polls were all screwed up, the cell phones, the landlines. And last night, David Axelrod was just saying, I don't know, he was like, the cell phones, the landlines. And I think that what we're going to see is a period of true transition in polling innovation. And we're going to see some really smart ways of polling come out, and we should look, and so we can probably start to trust them more and more. That's my guess.
The statistic I saw was that 17% of the voters in this election were first-time voters. I'll start with you, Katie. Do you think those first-time voters, like the barista you were talking to, or the server you were talking
Rob.
To? She's coming back with your money. Okay.
I did. I texted him because I got his number, because I said, let's stay in touch. And then I said, oh no, I forgot to give you a tip.
Yeah, that was very smooth, by the way. but my point is just these first time voters. I mean, there are people who are going to vote every election, no matter what. The last election I didn't vote in because I was too young to vote. I don't need to be hyped up to vote. I don't need the other side to be demonized to get me to vote. I think, and I know a lot of our audience, you're much the same way. Those folks who did need to get hyped up, do they need to be hyped up again for the next year's elections, and then for the primaries, and then for 2020? Or do you think, what's your sense of their experience that they had, and do they understand that voting is a lifelong thing? It's not a one-off.
I think that they need reasons to stay engaged. I think that's going to be a big part of that puzzle, is they need to have candidates they're excited about, issues they care about, to get out there and vote. You know, there was a lot of talk of celebrities inspiring young people to vote, Taylor Swift most prominently. And I do think that did have some impact. You know, if voting is cool, that's, you know, that matters. And social media played a big role. You know, on Instagram yesterday, they had a special feature where if you posted a story saying that you voted, they like featured it in this special wheel. So, you know, I think that aspect of it, you can't overlook what that means to young people. But I think, you know, once you start voting, obviously you're more likely to keep voting, but I do think you need to be inspired. And also I think you need to make voting easier. You know, we have pretty good voting laws here. It's pretty easy to vote. You know, you can file a provisional ballot the day of if you didn't register. You can register online. You can send your ballot in early. You can go early vote. You can go to the polls. It's not like that for everyone. So I think we need to take a hard look at voting laws across the country if you're going to keep young people engaged. And
I'd like to point out also that you should all encourage other people to vote, because then more of them get into the jury pools and you're less likely to be called.
Oh.
Melissa?
Well, I think, you know, it's... it's a great point.
Wait a minute. But we want to be jurors. But that's another whole thing. Yeah. Okay.
Katie wants to be jurors.
Yeah, I don't
Melissa?
Know about this we want to be. No, so here's the thing. I think it's going to really depend, right? So people have come out, you know, a lot of folks voting for the first time or sending, you know, groundbreaking people to Congress. Yeah. If they don't see results, I mean, you talk to people, the number one reason people will tell you why they don't vote is because they think it doesn't matter. And so what they also need to see is that their vote is going to matter. And so if they don't, then it's less likely that the kind of momentum will continue. If they'll go, remember back in 2018 when I voted, and then who cared? Like, you know what I mean? Like, they need to be able to see, you know, a direct response to sure. that effort. And if they don't, then I think, you know, you can see those numbers going down in the future. Also in California, one of the things that we had this election that we've never had before, which is interesting, is the same day registration and voting. Now, Santa Clara managed to make this really difficult. And there were people outside until 10:30, 10:45 at night waiting wow. in line to get in and register and vote at the same time. Now, this is good if you're a student or somebody who moves around a bit. You know, it's easier to do that way. But some places are still, I guess, obviously working out the kinks. San Francisco, I think, did it pretty well. They got people in and out pretty quickly. But this new thing, this I'm going to register and vote at the same time on election day, could have a big impact on the elections moving forward. So we're still waiting to get the data on how that shook out and how many people came in and who those people were and how that impacted the elections. But that's another, you know, way we're doing this. And it's a little uncharted territory here in California. Hopefully in elections going forward, everyone will figure out how to do it really quickly. So no one's waiting in line until 10 o'clock at night.
Katie, your thoughts on the first-time voters, their experience, their enthusiasm, their future as voters?
Yeah, I agree with Molly. You have to have a reason to keep voting. We can't get complacent. The minute we get complacent, we think, A, it doesn't matter if I vote. B, I've got what I want. C, it doesn't matter. So we have to keep people energized. And I think, you know, just to get back to Nancy Pelosi for one sec, she knew with these young, really young people really kind of coming after her. I mean, there are a lot of these young people in Congress now who don't agree with her, especially the women who want to see the fresh blood. And she so believes in getting this done. Her mantra was just win. You know, it just I don't care what you think of me, just win. And so if that can then trickle down to, you know, young people, it's like just vote.
Okay. Let's get through some more of your questions before we get to the news quiz. Someone points out, I said early in the beginning of the program, I mentioned that Jeff Sessions, I said he had been fired, and they pointed out he resigned at the request of the President of the United States. technically correct, but I mean, if my boss comes and tells me that she's requesting that I resign, I did not move on to happier things. Okay, so also a number of questions here about... Okay, actually related to that first one, what happens to the Mueller investigation now? Can the new House in any way protect Mueller? Any thoughts? Especially because if you're reading the stuff that I'm seeing, could be interesting news coming down about Donald Trump Jr. from Mueller. He apparently is telling people he expects to be indicted. So any thoughts on the Mueller investigation and the new Washington constellation?
Well, one thing that can happen now that Democrats are in control of the House is reopen the investigation in these committees, and they have subpoena power. So they can start subpoenaing John Jr. and all the people that they did earlier when Devin Nunes was in charge and the investigation wasn't quite as robust.
Devin who?
So he is still in Congress, but no longer the chairman of the committee. But he will be... there, obviously, but Democrats will have the power to kind of do the things their way. So I think that'll be an important tool that they'll be able to use.
I think they can also subpoena Mueller's files.
Yeah.
So even if, let's say, tomorrow he's, you know, escorted out of the building, there's still the files. There's still all his investigations and legal activities up to this date. And I think that they can subpoena those and get a hold of them. And then, depending on what's in them, make public or not certain of those things and try to the best of their ability to continue on with whatever he started. I'll also point out, even if he is removed, there's nothing stopping, he's already started laying the groundwork, him from passing on whatever information he has to state attorneys general, for example, for their pursuit of some of these things. So even if everything ended today, which I don't think it would for a lot of reasons, there are some other avenues, one involving the House, the other involving the states like New York, which are pretty Democrat-friendly.
Okay. This question might be one that actually has to wait for more of the forensics that are kind of found out after an election fully shakes out. But someone asks how John Cox's vote in the state, where it came from, do we know? Did he do better than previous Republicans? I mean, just how did he perform in this election?
Well, he did a lot better than Neel Kashkari. I mean, and he did it without many resources. I mean, the Republican national, fundraisers didn't give him anything. He was largely self-funded. He raised some money in California, but he was really left on his own to a large degree. And to get, he's got 40%, I think, is where he is right now. Mm-hmm. But 40% in a state that's, 25%. 5% maybe Republican, that means he's pulling a lot of independents over. And so to even get to 40% with so few resources in a state with our demographics and our voter registration numbers means that there's a lot of folks who are not, no party preference, or Democrats, who knows, who are not, inclined to vote for Newsom.
Like Jerry Brown.
He came out the last day.
He did.
The night before the election, Jerry Brown came out and gave this full-throated endorsement of Gavin Newsom. I was like, really? Today.
Yes, just a side note to that. You might want to check out The New Yorker, I think an issue or so ago, quite a long article on Newsom, following him through the primary and then after he got the nomination. And actually a very candid look on how he sees himself, how he makes decisions, as well as his relationship with Jerry Brown. So that's worth finding.
During the speech, Brown said, as he often does, that I'm going to retire to the farm. I'm going to the farm. I'm going to go spend my days at the farm. And he goes, but I'm only an hour from Sacramento, so don't screw it up.
Okay, well, last question along the same lines. What do you expect from initiatives and an agenda from Governor Newsom? Anyone? Molly?
I think, the resistance.
He did signal that in his speech.
Yeah, that's going to be it. I do think he's going to be a little bit more aggressive than Jerry Brown has been. I think we'll see a lot more of these bills that go through the legislature get signed. Jerry Brown always had, some reservations about some of the more progressive things that went through. I think we might see more talk about things, like healthcare reform here, stronger immigration protections, although they're already pretty good. But I think we're going to see a lot of him out there publicly rebuking Trump. So I think we can expect to see a lot of our governor on TV in the next few years.
Do you agree, Melissa?
I do. But he's also talked about something that Jerry Brown hasn't, and I think he kind of has to, which is homelessness. And one of the things he's talked about is one of the reasons he was against Prop C is he said, San Francisco cannot solve this problem. You can have $1 billion, $10 billion, and it's not going to solve the problem. Every time you house certain number of people appear. And so he said it has to be a regional problem. So he said one of the things he wants to do is regionalize it so that instead of giving grants to cities and counties, you give a grant to a region and you sort of force them to work together to spend the money and to create, better systems so that it's not just San Francisco trying to solve a problem where, people are coming from Richmond and Newark and, other places, to come to the place that has the most resources. So he said he's going to start doing that. And that's something that Jerry Brown has not ever really gotten too far into. I think he understands that it's a really tough problem to solve. But Newsom, as the former governor of San Francisco, always was going to get these questions. And so it's something that he's taken on. I think he's said enough about it that people are going to want to hold him to that. And so I think that's going to be something new that you're going to see from the Newsom administration. The other thing is Newsom doesn't actually have the kind of gravitas that Governor Brown does, just from his years in Sacramento. I think you might see a little more tension between him and the legislature. Governor Brown sort of knows exactly how to pull the levers and, you know, get things pushed through. There may be times, you guys might remember when Gavin Newsom was here, he did not always get along with the Board of Supervisors, to put it mildly. And so you may see some more, at least initially, until there's mutual respect built up, a little more pushback, a little, maybe even a veto override, depending. So so there may be a little more fighting between the executive and legislative branches, at least initially, in the Newsom administration, which does start in January, just to remind everyone. I think everyone's like, and tomorrow I'm going to be doing that. And you're like, no, not tomorrow. in January, when he gets into office. Those are just a couple things that, that may be different.
Katie, any thoughts on Governor Newsom? Well, and in particular, healthcare. That was one thing he talked about for a while.
He did. I mean, I hope you, I have to say yesterday, I wrote in Mark Benioff, just kidding. I'm a little skeptical. I think he's talked a lot. He has said a lot. And let's hope that he follows through on that. It's so much easier to say things than to get them done. And homelessness is such an incredibly intractable problem. He knows that. And then the healthcare situation is also, I mean, there were two states that actually voted to expand Medicaid, and they were Idaho and Nebraska, which was surprising, but go them. And let's hope that Newsom can do real things.
Okay, well, on that note, let's do our full news quiz now. I'm going to ask the question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. If we could have the lights up so we don't feel like we're being interrogated up here. And Barbara will be distributing our prizes. These prizes you can actually eat, unlike the books.
Is it good chocolate?
Yes. It's Ghirardelli chocolate. It's San Francisco chocolate. Only the best.
Yay.
Okay. The first question. More than 10,000 phone calls had been made yesterday before noon about what? It's related to what we're talking about. We're back, sir?
Problems with the voting machines.
That's right. Problems with the voting machines, long lines, complaints. That's correct.
Aww.
Next question. Who was asked at a press conference recently, quote, "Are you both prepared for federal prison?" Did anyone see the story? It was a good story.
Oh my.
No one? Sir?
Manafort Jr.?
No, not Manafort Jr. Back there?
Logan Hart?
No.
Good
there
guess.
Are a number of people you
it
could ask
like
these questions
for. There are so many good guesses.
Yes, in the pink. Sorry? Nope, they'll get asked her later. one more try, sir? No, it was conspiracy theorist Jacob Wall and right-wing radio host Jack Berkman. They were the ones who pushed this claim that Robert Mueller had sexually assaulted a woman.
Right, yeah.
Berkman replied, "No, we are not." it's worth looking up that video because it's
pretty great.
It is such an amateurish press conference. It's like, you know, summer stock theater in a small town compared to Broadway. It's great. Okay, let's give away some more chocolate here. Costco is selling something you might want to bring to our next week-to-week members social. For $79.99, what can you buy? It's 46 inches tall. Way in back there. A wine glass, that is correct.
Oh, wow.
46.
Not everything's politically related here. So President Trump was interviewed by Sinclair Broadcasting, and he was asked if he regretted anything from his first 2 years in office. He said yes. What was it? Sir, ma'am, sorry.
Yes. He was regretful that his tone was too harsh.
That's correct. He said his tone was too harsh, but it was the Democrats' fault. people are telling a federal judge in New York that they fear for their lives, if they are selected for the jury in the trial of what infamous international criminal? Sir, along that
El Chapo.
El Chapo, that's right.
How'd you like to be
Joaquin
on that
Guzman.
Jury? Unbelievable.
definitely.
Yeah. So she wants to be on the jury.
Yeah. Civic duty.
Yes, more people are now qualified because they voted. So after they appeared at a Trump rally, Fox News rebuked whom? Ma'am. Sean Hannity, actually. Yeah, Sean with Jean Pirro, but Sean was the leader there. That's correct. They appeared at a Trump rally, and Sean said it was really kind of a, what was it? Did he call it a mistake or a spur of the moment thing? Or
yeah, the president was like, hey, Sean, you're here. Come on upstage. Come on up on stage. And Sean
was
like,
he was listed on the event on Trump's website as being a special guest. So yes. Just keep that in mind.
In a Twitter battle, actor Jim Carrey urged Democratic voters to defeat what U.S. senator that he compared to an undead vampire? Right there. Sorry? Ted Cruz, that is correct. This is a question that this is the perfect audience to ask. According to People magazine, who is the sexiest man alive? Ma'am? Come on.
No, back here.
No. Ma'am?
Idris Elba.
Try again, next. Idris Elba, your possible next James Bond, by the way. Just a few more. Apparently, that was the most talked about question I've asked all night. Dude, that's amazing. Mexico's ruling party is making plans to present legislation to legalize what? Sir?
Marijuana.
That's correct. And let's see. Six people linked to the far right have been detained in Europe in connection with a violent plot to assassinate whom? Sir in the blue. Emmanuel Macron, French president. That is correct. And Barbara, I believe we have one left after that. Am I counting? Cray? Here's one that frankly saddened me because I did not know this about this person. Citing his anti-Semitic views, Britain's Royal Mint rejected plans to issue a commemorative coin on the 100th anniversary of the birth of what famous author? What famous children's author? No? I'm destroying all of your childhood. You know, like, oh, not that one. Anyone? Oh, I'm sorry, sir. Roald Dahl, that's correct.
Oh, no, really?
Yep. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh. There are no heroes.
James and the Giant Peach. Well, listen, we're going to have a lot more news quiz questions and obviously a lot more to talk about on Tuesday, December 11th. We're also going to have our holiday party. It's going to be a great night. It's going to be a full house. So hope you can join us.
Bring your Costco wine glasses.
Yes. Thanks to our great panel, Melissa Kane, Katie Hefner, and Molly Riley. And thanks to all of you and everyone watching and listening online. Have a great rest of your week.